Welcome to The Inner Game. I'm Gwen Garcelon, your host. Thanks for listening. Instead of the intro I normally do to start the show, we're going to time travel back almost 10 years together. I'm going to share with you an interview I did in July of 2009 with one of my most treasured mentors. At the time, my children were 1 and 3 years old, and I was a single mother, as I am now. I had just started a new business as a coach and consultant, and was recording interviews with some of the incredible social entrepreneurs who had been my colleagues over the previous decade in my work as an organizer and activist. So you'll hear me mention the Quantum Activist Network, which was the platform I was building at the time. And you'll recognize the intro music from Peter Mayer that I'm using still for The Inner Game. Please enjoy this rich conversation with evolutionary social entrepreneur Robert Egger.
Welcome. This is Gwen Garcelon here at the Quantum Activist Network, where we come together in community to be empowered in our purpose and in action in our lives, serving the common good. As we awaken our collective consciousness, we tap into the power of our collective reality. We are a 6 billion member strong collective reality here on planet Earth, and we have the choice to acknowledge the strength of that rather than bemoan and fear it. We have the choice to include each other in our decisions, in the way we live our lives, in our everyday habits. Gandhi advised that whenever you are feeling unsure and overwhelmed by your life, to think of the poorest person you have ever seen and ask yourself how your actions will impact that person. And as you take the well-being of others into account, you find your own fears and weakness melting away. Good advice. I've been loving Thich Nhat Hanh's latest book, The Art of Power, where he includes an entire chapter on the importance of sparking a collective awakening. Hanh, a Buddhist monk who was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Martin Luther King, says everyone is responsible. The situation is too important to leave to the politicians alone. Without collective awakening, nothing will happen. Awakening is the foundation of every kind of change. Each of us has to sit down and look deeply to see what we can be and what we can do today. So together, here in the Quantum Activist community, we listen, we learn, and we look deeply at what we can do and be, and we awaken. Our guest today, Robert Egger, was looking around at his world in Washington, D.C. years ago, and instead of being overwhelmed by the homelessness and injustice around him, he decided he could do something very powerful and creative to address it. He founded the D.C. Central Kitchen, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit that recovers unused food from hotels and restaurants, prepares and delivers meals to partner social service agencies, and trains and employs homeless men and women for the food service industry. Robert Egger has been awarded and acknowledged up the wazoo. I think that's the definitive measurement. But to name a few, he's been on the Nonprofit Times list of the 50 most powerful and influential leaders the last 3 years running. His book, Begging for Change, received the Nonprofit Management Book of the Year Award. And one of my personal favorites, he made Oprah Magazine's shortlist of the real sexiest men alive. We're so lucky to have Robert with us. I know him to be a relentless mover and shaker, a huge humanitarian, and really just one of those people who you are so damn grateful is in the world doing what they do. So, Robert, welcome to the Quantum Activist Network.
Well, thank you, Gwen. Man, I tell you, with an intro like that, I'm thrilled to be here.
This is where we pick up part two of the conversation. When we ended part one, Robert was talking about the evolution of the nonprofit sector and the choices that those in the millennial generation are making. Mainly, the choice to live their lives more simply and to have their lifestyle choices be their philanthropy in the world, rather than to accumulate wealth in destructive businesses and then give back some of those profits, which was more of a defining practice of the baby boomer generation. Here's Robert.
At the same time, you've got 80 million baby boomers, and I'm going to generalize here, but I think what you're going to see on a predictable day in the future is when the vast majority of the boomers cross 60 and realize that they're on the long and winding road is coming to an end, I think what you're going to see is a lot of people looking in the mirror and thinking, dang, man, I heard Dr. King and Marvin Gaye you know, John Kennedy with my own ears. Mm-hmm. How did I stray so far mm-hmm. from the garden? How did I come to believe that if I just bought more junk, I'd be happy? And they're going to look and they're going to say, you know, there's still time left, and they're going to come pouring out into the community trying to find, if I may be so bold as to suggest, a little bit of redemption. So this is almost a once in a millennium energy that you're going to see, where you have two giant generations, frankly, bookends of two of the most richest, freest, most educated generations in the history of the planet, equally at the same time kind of looking for a new way to live.
And do you think they'll be able to work together? Like, what will that look like?
Well, that's the challenge, Glenn. This is such a great conversation, because this is the great nexus, the great moment, because this is the energy that the nonprofit sector has to be prepared to channel.
Yeah.
And as it exists, it won't. As it exists, it needs money. It's we're all chasing money.
Yeah.
And what you have is because there's a kind of a saturated market, and there's very few standards that unite us or market forces that drive us forward. That's what I worry about. So you're right, though. There is this huge moment in which there's a shift. There's a mandated need for change, because again, there's energy we have to channel. Mm-hmm. But what's also coming up, and I think it's going to be rough for some, but it's going to be this new sense of accountability. In other words, we're going to move beyond the era in which donors say, you know, what's your administrative overhead? But then there's going to start to really, I think, look for, and I think many of us are trying to provide, a greater depth of understanding about what a good nonprofit is.
Mm-hmm.
And with that will come, I think, the kind of thinning of the herd that must happen. And that's kind of a crass. I apologize to any of our listeners that might sound kind of a crass way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, what we need is fewer but stronger, robust, visionary nonprofits versus thousands that are anemic and starving and just, you know, wandering in relentless pursuit of a little bit of money to keep the electricity on.
So maybe there'll be the advent of new tools, new forms of support, new mentoring that will allow for, you know, a much greater level of accountability production.
Yeah, and so there's that, but at the same time, there's a lot of us that are exploring social enterprise and saying, for example, we have a little food cart we just bought. It's one of the first of many, I hope. But the idea is, what would it be like? So you have to understand, we're really good at what we do. We're on our 75th class, and we're about to graduate a class of 20 men and women next week, but half are struggling to find a job because they have really serious prison records.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working really, really hard to stay on the straight and narrow. But it's going to be very difficult, not only in this economy, but also basically in this culture, to find a job as a felon.
Mm-hmm.
So I can lament the fates, or I can adapt. And what we've decided to do is start launching more and more businesses in which we create jobs ourselves.
Right.
But I can't hire all the felons. You know, just so you know, going back to me running nightclubs, what I do is I put on shows. And this is a classic example, is we went out and bought a little food cart. For your listeners who maybe have been to our nation's capital, you know, really, here is in an international city, but there's very few food carts on the street that sell things besides hot dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, wow, there's a huge opportunity there. What would it be like then if we bought the cart, but then we loaned, a la Muhammad Yunus, some of our graduates a little bit of money so they can lease the cart and own their own business?
Mm-hmm.
We also have a catering company. And everyone who is, you know, we hire graduates, and everyone who works there starts at 12:50 an hour with full health care benefits, retirement, family leave. And we also purchase as much as we can of our produce locally. So in theory, you know, our catering company is using locally grown produce to produce the food that is then sold on the carts, so that if somebody comes and buys lunch, they're helping a felon own a business, pay taxes, stay out of prison. They're helping men and women at the catering company make a living. And they're also helping local farmers. Now, there's so many different levels, it's cool, but mm-hmm. the big door I'm trying to open is all you had to do was have lunch, and
right.
those three powerful things happen.
Right.
What do you do? What are the rest of the things you purchase every day?
Mm-hmm.
You know, every single purchase, and this is what Dr. King and Gandhi and Cesar Chavez kind of opened the door to with their boycotts.
Mm-hmm.
They said, in effect, if you don't ride the bus,
right.
if you don't buy salt, if you don't buy grapes, the machine stops.
Exactly.
And what I'm interested in is, and I know this sounds heretical because I certainly don't want to cast aspersions on the tactics of those brilliant, brilliant humanitarians, but I've always been intrigued, if you'll follow me for a second, by frankly, the almost negative energy of a boycott.
Mm-hmm.
Because as much as all three men spoke eloquently about nonviolence,
yep.
at the end of the day, a boycott is designed to inflict hardship.
It's just a big no instead of a big
right.
yes about something.
Bingo. So I'm interested in, I think what would have been bold, and I think Dr. King was going towards this, was to say to people at that moment of victory, now that I've shown you the power of no, now I'm going to expose you to the power of yes. Let's flip this from the boycott to the boycott.
Right.
And let's reward, let's create incentives, let's reward people who do the right thing. So to me, at the end of the day, what I'm looking for is to create a new generation of businesses that don't wait for government to mandate a living wage. They pay it because their customers support it.
Mm-hmm.
And if the average person walks down the street, has that moment, much like Dorothy did at the end of The Wizard of Oz, where she realized, oh my goodness, it was in my backyard all along. I went all over to God's Green Earth looking for it, and was right there all along. I know this sounds goofy, but you know, the boomers since 1968, when Dr. King and Robert Kennedy were shot, you know, 2 months apart, we've been 40 years, metaphorical, 40 years in the wilderness, looking for salvation with money and junk and stuff. And I think what you're going to see is people coming back to that same moment Dorothy did, where they realize, oh my goodness, you know, I was on the right journey, just on the wrong road.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, for me, there are powerful doorways that are being cracked open right now. And what I'm open to do with a lot of other people is just push them open wider still.
Yeah. Oh, I'm getting shivers.
Me too.
You know, something we really love to talk about here on the Quantum Activist Network is how we really stay in the game powerfully and in a balanced way and with health and vitality. And I know you have a pretty demanding travel schedule and work schedule, and you're also a husband and a dad. And what are the kinds of things that support you in keeping it all together and, you know, feeling like you are showing up with your best? How does that happen?
Well, you know, I got to be honest with you. I mean, it's rare that I ever kind of, you know, I'm like, you know, any other person, you know, I have my ups and downs. But I really do have a lot of energy. I've come to realize it's like, man, you know, I'm on a real mission here.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things that I think are really important. As you suggested, man, you know, my wife and I drink champagne every Friday night together.
Mm.
You know, it's Friday today. It's champagne Friday night at Dagger House. You know, I work really hard to keep our love alive.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a walker.
Mm-hmm.
I walk a lot. I walk through my city.
Yeah.
And for any of your young listeners out there, a lot of young people come and say, man, I want to be, you know, I really want to get out there and make something happen. You know, what are some of the secrets?
Mm-hmm.
And I tell young people all the time, man, it's like unplug the iPod.
Yep.
Plug into your community, man. You'll never be able to make change in your community unless you know it.
Yeah.
Unless you smell it, feel it, hear it.
Yep.
You know, and you got to process it. You got to explore your town every day.
Yeah.
So walk with your eyes open, your ears open, your heart open.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and absorb your town, process your town, learn your town. You know, and so that's what I do. I mean, I'm relentlessly excited by life. I mean, I just wake up every day just like right on another day. Let's rock.
This is Gwen Garcelon, and you're listening to The Inner Game on KD&K. Today we're listening to an interview I did in 2009 with Robert Egger on the evolving role of nonprofit organizations in our world.
And how do you share your work with your daughter? I love, you know, the way I've seen kids who grow up with, you know, really involved, civic-minded parents and what an impact that has. What does that look like in your life?
Well, you know, I think my daughter's only beginning to explore. She's 19 and just back from college, her first year. And frankly, you know, she's been at the kitchen all her life, but she's never been one of those kind of like, you know, here every day, part of the gang thing. She's like a lot of kids in America. And frankly, you know, as an only child, I maybe gave her a little bit of a, you know, kind of like the princess thing, spoiled her a little bit more than that's my dad's prerogative. But this summer she's been down and she's been doing street outreach all summer long. And, you know, we have trucks that go out in the morning with breakfast, and the idea is to volunteers like Julia will serve breakfast while the outreach workers try and engage people in a process that brings them in off the street. But so maybe in a way, I kind of there were times I tried to get her involved earlier, but I didn't want to push. But it's been an interesting path that's led her here to now she's embracing it, let's put it that way, to the point where I think when she goes back to Olympia, where she's in school, Olympia, Washington, she will, you know, actively pursue some volunteer opportunities there, if not even considering maybe opening one of the campus kitchen projects, which is another one of the things we do here at the DC Central Kitchen.
So do you think it's just sort of through osmosis that it rubs off, even if the kids aren't actively involved, when they see their parents involved, it just has to have an impact, I'm imagining.
It does, but you know, I got to tell you, man, I'm overwhelmed by this younger generation, the millennials. I mean, the Xers rock, don't get me wrong. You know, I love every generation.
I'm an Xer.
But this younger generation, man, you know, they've really been raised doing community service, and,
yeah.
You know, sometimes it was mandated.
Yep.
But the point is, you know, we have 12,000 volunteers go through every year, and that's really, frankly, how we fight hunger. It's not food. It's basically trying to engage volunteers, not telling them what to think, but setting the stage. We call it the calculated epiphany. You know, we want to set the stage so when people come in, they have their own moment of awakening, you know, mm-hmm. here. And then they go and basically, you know, kind of, you know, preach the little gospel and they leave. But, you know, I've seen so many of these young kids, just like my daughter, kind of come through here, some of them like, yeah, I just got to be here, or some of them being a little bit afraid or mm-hmm. whatever, but I just watch this amazing metamorphosis happen. And this is happening every day across this country, and I really don't think we recognize what it represents for this country's future to have a college system full, I mean, brim, to the brim full of a generation who are coming out looking for a very, very different kind of life. And the tragedy, talk about one of the dumbest things we've ever done in our country's history, is say to this generation of kids on graduation day, now you must choose. Do you want to do good or do you want to make money? You know, do you want to be a .com or a .org?
Yeah, what a limiting thing.
Oh, it's
like,
it's
let's
insane.
Do it all. Let's make it all happen.
And that's what they're saying.
Yeah.
You know, excitingly so, they're saying, and this is every generation's birthright,
yeah.
is to say to the previous generation, with all due respect, no.
Yeah.
And I am like right on,
yeah.
reinvent,
yeah.
completely, tear it up, come
yeah.
on, bring me your ideas, I
want
to hear
on.
It. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, I definitely see that too, and I think there's a real opportunity for nonprofits in opening their doors. I mean, I don't know, so many do, you know, there's all the internships, and, you know, that's part of this movement is the open door policy and, you know, really including, you know, the younger generation in lots of creative ways.
But, you know, there's a huge difference, my sister, in opening your doors and opening your heart and your mind. And what you have to do, and this is where I think it's one of the most interesting opportunities, but what's missing is oftentimes we think we have to teach a younger generation how to lead. The reality is they're ready to lead. We have to teach an older generation how to let go.
Yes.
And no one really recognizes that it's just not natural to let go.
Yes.
It's not natural to give up power. It has to be taught. And this is what interests me. You know, here we are running nonprofit management schools. We should be really teaching kids, how do you avoid the trap of control?
Yes.
You know, how do you share the decision-making process so that when you start your organization, you don't have to waste valuable years struggling to control stuff that you can't.
Right.
You know, embrace the notion of an open hand. You know, so what I'm hoping an older generation, maybe some of your listeners, you know, who are kind of digging this, is, you know, if you do have volunteers, ask them what they think. You know, if you got young volunteers, if you got young staff people, pull them in. You know, recently I sat down with all the under 30s. And, you know, and I think it's very important to do every couple of months is sit down and say, you know, what do you think we should do next? What do you like? What do you not like?
Mm-hmm.
And just listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, just the art of listening, just the respect of saying, what do you think? You'd be amazed at dividends. And quite frankly, conversely, I'm always amazed with what they come up with. I mean,
yeah.
as I've said, man, some of their ideas are Fruit Loops, but others are brilliant.
Right.
And it's like, dang, I never would have thought of that. That is so cool. Can you do that? Would you be in charge of that project?
Right. Can you take that on?
You know, yeah. So, I mean, it's a breathtaking thing. It's risky, and it's challenging. And frankly, what's going to be necessary is for us to embrace ideas that for many of us are counterintuitive. You know, when you say to you know, a certain generation, start businesses, employ people. You know, it's like, wait, I've never run, you know, I don't do that. It's like, yeah, you do, and you don't have a choice. This is what must happen. Because, you know, frankly, the era of extra in the nonprofit sector has been completely built on extra money,
mm-hmm.
extra food, extra time. That's ending in America. There's no more extra. You know, and what we have to do is start to think very, very differently about how we use our resources. And again, I think our greatest resource in this country is the entrepreneurial spirit, the idealism, that sense of independence that all people want, that's what we should be doing in the nonprofit sector, man, is a big independence movement.
Right. I love that. You know, you said you You didn't go to college, but you are obviously a lifetime learner. I'm wondering, you know, how that happens. I know you're always asking questions. Are you a big reader? What other things do you do to, you know, keep getting new ideas and keep learning and growing?
Well, you know, I read, although I read almost pure history. I adore history, and I've really tried to develop that keen sense of not just reading the words, but what did it smell like? You know, what were the sounds? You know, what were the emotions of the time? And again, the other thing, I've really trained my eyeball to see the world a little bit sideways. I mean, and you know, there's a certain amount of me, well, it's just the way I was wired. But I mean, really, I walk around the city. And you know, if I can use an example, I came up in the 1970s, again, in the nightclub world, it was that new wave era. So we were all, you know, this was the beginning of that kind of thrift store shopping and skinny ties and, you know, sweater vests and all that kind of crazy mismatch. But I mean, when you go to the original thrift stores, there would be like this giant wall of shirts. And you know, when you first go, you look at each one and you're like, damn, this is going to take forever. So you start to, you know, you train your eye. And you can literally walk with your eyeballs, walk down and see, and you pick out, you know, patterns, weave, buttons that indicate, you know, this is the kind of shirt I'm looking for. Well, in a way, I've done the same thing with my life. I've trained my eye to walk through my city, and I look for things, you know, and I'm always on the hunt. And frankly, I've almost developed little, almost safaris, for lack of a better word. You know, I carry around a little BlackBerry, you know, one of those little, you know, handheld things.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about it, it's got a camera, and I have a variety of, you know, I'm a big believer in new media. I'm a relentless Facebooker, Twitterer,
mm-hmm.
blogger,
mm-hmm.
but I have a bunch of Facebook, and anybody wants to be Facebook friends, bring it on.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a bunch of little photo archives. Yeah, you know, I take pictures. I have a thing called Revolution on the Road, Love on the Road, Flowers. I mean, I'm always hunting for things, but this is an exercise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, I created these so that it forces me when I go to new cities.
Mm-hmm.
When I walk around, I don't just walk around blind. I walk around with my eyes wide open hunting
mm-hmm.
for things. And it's just a way to train my eyes to stay open and always be looking for things, you know, to help me see things. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's exercise.
Right.
I sometimes wish in my old age that my body was a little bit more taut than it is, but I got to tell you, man, my soul is buff.
Oh, and that's really our goal, isn't it? You know, it's like where the real joy comes from. You know, that you got a buff soul. I love it.
Yeah, man, you can only do so much with you know, with flesh and bone, and
yeah.
Gravity's a bitch, you know. But man, you can always keep the soul exercised.
Yeah. Oh, Robert, I just love this conversation. I could talk for a long time, but I see that our time is coming to a close, and you know, I just want to invite you to you know, to say anything that you'd like to say, sort of in closing, to encourage our folks to be part of the awakening that we've been talking about.
Well, man, you know, change is essential. Change is unstoppable. So my attitude, you know, as a young man, my cousin Roger, who I really love, was a surfer. And I used to watch him, you know, and his whole thing was, man, you can't plan the wave, baby, you just got to ride it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes you fall, but you get back on and you ride another. And, man, I've always embraced that kind of surfer culture, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, man, you know, if I can tell your friends anything, man, it's just like, cowabunga, man, life is a wave, you know, hang 10, and I'll see you on the beach.
Oh, it's a good one. It's a good party on that beach. I'm going to be there with you too, Robert.
There you go, baking potatoes in the sun, my sister.
Well, many, many thanks to you for all that you do, and thanks to all of you listening. And we, until next time, be in joy and be in action. And we will see you again very soon.
Clouds are swift. Rocks are ancient. Mountains are high, oceans gray. Winds are restless, trees are patient. You, my child, are away. Waves are crashing. Rivers churning, planets twirling, stars ablaze. Storms are raging, atoms whirling. And you, my child, tell a story and dance and sing. All the splendors of creation are very happy that you came, because they needed someone to see them, and you, my child, are away.